I'm Brenda Tremblay, welcoming you to this podcast from WXXI in Rochester, New York. She's performed for American presidents and foreign kings and queens. She sung at the 2002 Winter Olympics and at the inauguration of President Jimmy Carter, made her debut at the Met in 1970. Frederica von Stade is appearing in Rochester with her friend and colleague Anthony Dean Griffey in concert Sunday night at 7 o'clock in Kilburn Hall. It's a benefit concert for opera students at the Eastman School of Music. And I'm Brenda Tremblay, welcoming you to this podcast. I was the lucky one to get to be able to sit down with both Frederica and Tony Griffey to talk to them about many, many things: the Me Too movement in classical music, the repertoire that they're going to be presenting, how singing is like being an athlete, and first of all, how they met.
I think we met through Joyce, through our manager.
Yes, we met. I was a young artist at the Metropolitan Opera, and I was struggling a bit. I've always been a person in search of truth in my life. And so I had kind of been thrust from North Carolina to Rochester, where I did my master's, and then to New York City, where I was at Juilliard and then in the Met Young Artist Program. And I really thought I was destined to be a minister. So I'm a different type of minister now. I minister kind of to the whole world, I think, instead of being in one church. And Flicka had, Miss von Stade, had a meeting with Joyce that day, I assume. And we were overlapping and met each other. And I was just starstruck because I had grown up listening to her recordings, especially in college, of her beautiful French melody. And, you know, we had LPs then, we didn't have the CDs, and her beautiful concert with Andre Previn and Kathleen Battle which was live on PBS. I put it on through the whole year, not just at the Christmas season, but I was just a huge fan. And I was, maybe she sensed that I was feeling a little bit, you know, out of my tree that day, but she said, just be true to yourself. Just remind yourself who you are. And I've tried to live my life that way in truth. So it's exciting and fantastic for our students and for the community of Rochester and the faculty at Eastman to have such a fantastic artist and a person who also is a giving soul, not just in her art form, but in her life.
Thank you, Tony.
So what do you mean by be true to yourself? What does that mean? And how did that play out in your own career?
I think, you know, when I hear and see a lot of young artists now, first of all, they are so beautifully prepared. And there are so many young, magnificent voices around. I don't do many, many master classes, but the ones I do, I think, where do these kids come from? What are they drinking? They're just, what are they eating? It's fantastic. And I think that they're very beautifully prepared now. The young artists programs are exceptional. There is an exceptional group of teachers out there now that are very devoted to their students. I mean, talking to Tony a little bit about his students, it's a huge commitment to parent, you become shrink, you're not just a teacher. And it's different with singers because we're the only people that have our faces to the public. Even a flute has something in between or a violin. And so you put yourself in the position of incredible rejection. So part of bolstering up kids is giving them, yes, what they need to use their instrument with, but it's also taking care of their souls. And you can't imitate. There's nothing to imitate in singing. You have to, it's your own voice, it's your own spirit. And what keeps you safe in the music business is being yourself and not trying to be somebody else and trusting. And those people that you seek out to take care of you in the business are those people who help you to protect that, you know, or do it for you. And this wonderful agent that we had, Joyce Arbib, was a very spiritual gal. She became a nun in a cloistered order in Bethlehem, Connecticut. And when you know her, I mean, it was just a logical step. Her office was hysterical. There would be coffee cup rings on contracts, and things were being run over by her rollers on her desk. She had the greatest respect in the business because, A, she told the truth, and she really committed herself to her clients. And she adores Tony, so it's not hard to adore Tony. and she's always, you know, had a deep respect for that quality in artists. And I was probably in her office that day getting out of something, trying to find my way out of a contract. Because once you have kids, your life changes, and you need to accommodate that part of your family life. And so she was very good at getting me out of contracts.
That's funny. I've never thought about that before, the singer having a face to the audience unlike an instrumentalist. That's extremely, yeah. You know, insightful.
Yeah. Right. And it's something that I remind my students and other young singers that I come in contact with is that, you know, we're individuals who happen to be born with a gift to sing, and we try to perfect that to the best of our ability, but not to be a carbon copy. I mean, there's only one Frederica von Stada, you know. And I to come to that realization when I was younger, you know, that there was only one of me, and to develop that and say what I had to say and give that to the world, I think is an important facet for an artist to come to terms with.
Let me ask you about you talking about the quality of singing these days and the students coming to you at Eastman, for example. You hear so many amazing voices. What is the thing that helps someone stand out in that kind of field? Like, what are you listening for? You know, what is it that makes a really good singer, a potential, you know, Tony Griffey, fast-tracked, you know, into the world of opera?
I listen and look for individuality. Because I recently have been judging a lot of the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions, so I can always tell if a young soprano has listened to Renee Fleming. We love Renee Fleming, and she's from here, and she's a dear friend of mine. But the world really wants the next best you, and that sounds a little bit cliche, but it's yeah. really true. Is that we want the next best them, and not someone who's trying to imitate, you know. Of the pop world, you know, there was only one Elvis Presley. You know, you can play a drop the needle test. There was only one Dolly Parton. I come from a background of country music in my hometown and with my parents. So, and the same thing is true, I think, in opera and classical music is a signature voice and a signature personality and what you can bring new to the role.
So you could bring Honky Tonk to, you know, Benjamin Britten and Peter Grimes.
Exactly, yes.
Put a little swing in it. Yeah. I think the same thing. What impresses me is the natural quality of the voices, that there's just something deep. I mean, maybe, you know, I'm at that time in my life where I'm looking back on things. And when I hear a young singer like that, I think, oh my goodness, I am so thrilled they weren't around when I was trying to sing, because I would have been just I would have been out the door so fast. They're so educated too. You know, I think in my day, it might have been more that there were these incredible voices that came along. There were more jobs to a certain extent. Now there's such great preparation, there's such great teaching in languages and in background, and all of that becomes very, very important to them as human beings, that it's not just the voice. When you're performing, the more you can distract yourself from the voice, the better you are. And that's why you hang on to things like, who am I in this song? What is this song about? Who was Robert Schumann? What did he wanted to throw himself in the river at one point? Why is this? Why does this have a meaning? And that's what I find that is behind the kids of today, which I am deeply impressed by.
I was just going to say, just thinking about singers coming up, I mean, the same transformation is happening in so many fields. Like the Olympics, it used to be that a triple spin was a big deal. And now, you know, there's
now,
a kid that last night.
Sean White, he's, you know what, I don't like the triple jumps in skating. I'm, you know, I'm old-fashioned and old, and I'm a Sonja Henie type, you know, nobody will remember that name, but when a great skater comes along, it's more what the expression than the accomplishment. And I think sometimes these triple Lutzes and all this are taking away from the art part of skating. And now I know it's the Olympics and it's what you can do, but you know, I worry that there are going to be 25 kids who are going to try and do these Sean White moves and hurt themselves, you know. And one thing that impressed me so enormously about thinking about the Olympics is that, and he said it, I think, in one of his interviews, that, you know, you really are knocking at death's door quite often in a lot of these feats. You know, I mean, he was injured and many athletes. And there is a different aspect to it, but the performance part of it, I go for the artistic over the, you know, I get nervous every time I see they're about to jump. I think I'm distracted. I look away, put a pillow in front of my face. Well, now the Olympic Committee is going to come down on me for that. I know.
But it's very closely related to singing as well, though. I mean, you know, sometimes we often, you know, higher and who can sing the fastest coloratura.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It's very closely, you know, and I always am looking for the artistic side and what they bring to it. And, you know, it's exciting, you know, when someone has beautiful high notes or low notes or, but you also want to listen for the whole package, you know, and what they have to say as an artist. So.
Well, at the Olympics on the men's figure skating, there was a young American named Nathan Chen they expected to win gold medal, and he didn't do very well. And he skated back-to-back with this beautiful skater. I can't remember what country he was from, but he couldn't do the quadruple ones. He could only do the triple death-defying acts, you know. And they skated side by side, and definitely the young Nathan Chen was amazing. He skated, did the, like six of those things. But the young skater, I remember the skating of the other guy more because it was a whole piece.
Right.
It was beautiful. It was like a dance, you know. So interesting. Well, let's talk about your repertoire. And before we go on, I just want to double check and make sure nothing has happened next door. I'm sorry. I'm just.
Oh, it's okay.
All right. Please. I watched the young guy who didn't do well, and I could see his whole soul was.
And
held just before these darn jumps.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, on that given day, it's like with singing, you know, some days we wait. I always say, I'm always in my best voice when I do my laundry.
Yes.
You know, it's like I would. And then if I have a big engagement, I'm just like, oh, crap. What? And sometimes I'll do my laundry on the day that I have to do. You know, I try to find things that are normal that keep me grounded.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And, you know, one interesting thing that kind of goes neck and neck with sports to singing is I think these athletes train in a way that they have a whole psychological training as well. They'd have to. If you're out there, not just in the Olympics, but if you're in any sport, there has to be, especially tennis players, there has to be a process you've gone through to block out all the voices. Singers have little men that sit on their shoulders and say, oh, here comes the high note. Oh, no, that was flat. Oh, that's sharp. Oh, you've run out of breath. Oh, yep. There. And our job is really to knock them off our shoulders. But they're there anyway. And I think we could probably use some of that training in singing.
Well, singing is like an athletic
sport.
You've spoken about that.
Yeah. And it's it's in your body, so that it's, you know, it's subject to everything that's going on for you.
Let's talk about what you're going to sing tomorrow night at this benefit concert. What's on the list?
Well, when I contacted Flick about possibly coming to Eastman, I was a little bit unsure. You know, I was nervous. She is, you know, the one that we all know and love and has been this and still is this opera superstar. So I contacted her because part of my coming to Eastman is that I want to bring in artists that, you know, sometimes you think you can't touch, or you always wonder, well, how did she do it, or how did he do it, or how can I have, you know, a family and rear children and still have a career? Because there's really no fast track. I mentioned that I was sort of on a fast track. I was in some ways, but then emotionally I wasn't always, you know, prepared for what was happening, because it all happened rather quickly. So in me coming to Eastman, I wanted to make sure that I was helping them bring in artists of that could share, who really let their light shine and who live their truth and have something to say other than, you know, let's just see how beautiful we can make this high note, or what we can technically do. Is, you know, as teachers, we want to take our students as far as possible technically, because you have to sing on technique, and some days when you wake up with a cold and you have to rely on that vocal technique. But also I want them to have, you know, a spirit and a heart, and realize that, you know, being given a gift, that you must give it back, and that's what speaks in society. I'm sort of the opening act. I'm like, you know, as I mentioned, Elvis and Madonna and Adele, they all have an opening act. So I, when Flicka sent me this wonderful program that she had done in Dallas, I was like, you know, and she was so sweet and said, you know, I'd love you to do this recital with me. And I went a little bit reverted back to my always, I can't do a
that
recital.
That was greed, yeah, on my part.
So I thought, well, this is such a beautiful program, and her life and song, and this is what our students and the people in Rochester need to hear about, is this incredible artist and her experience through song. So I'm just kind of the opening act, and then she and I are putting together some things at the very end. So she's really the meat of the and heart and soul of the concert.
Well, you're singing this beautiful song at the beginning, Come Again.
Yes.
Sort of an invitation.
An invitation, yes, for everyone to join and on her journey through life and song.
Mm-hmm. Pretty lucky. It's like having, you know, Elvis Presley open for you.
Right.
So what are you singing, your life and song?
It is. They're just songs that have meant a great deal to me over the years. And I put it together for my farewell recital at Carnegie, a version of this. And so I do talk a little bit, not a lot. And it's, you know, I was born right after the war, and that it affected me deeply, you know. I was Catholic, raised very strict Catholic, so there's some songs about my background with nuns. I lived in Paris, and I didn't go to college. I was of the generation that really exceptional students went to college. It wasn't necessarily necessary. And I had always wanted to live in France, so I just took myself off to France for a year, and I learned an enormous amount in that year. And France in 1964 wasn't the way it is today, that you didn't telephone, you didn't have email, there was none of that. It was terrifying at some points, but I fell in love with the city and I really learned French. And then a little bit about, there's a wonderful song by Mahler that's the story of a contest between a cuckoo and an ass, and they're both singing. A cuckoo and a nightingale, excuse me, judged by an ass. And that had a certain relevance in my life, all the singing contests that we go through. And then I sing the aria that I sang for the Met auditions when I won a prize.
What was that?
It's an aria from Werther by Massenet, and it's the character is Charlotte, and she just bursts into tears at one point and says, oh my gosh, these tears just have to come out of me. And I had a sort of funny experience when I sang it at the Met, so I tell that story. And then I
Would you tell it now?
Oh, sure. There's a scene in the third act where she is, it's called the letter scene, and she is reading a letter from Werther, who she's in love with, and he's in love with her, but she's married to somebody else, and it's worrisome, to say the least. And to open the scene, it was a very beautiful old production of the Metz. The scene begins when she lights a candle. The lights come up, but you see her sort of a little bit. And so it was up to me to light the candle, and I struck the first match, and the match didn't light. And then the second match, and the match didn't light. And then the third. And meanwhile, the music is playing. I pretty soon, this has got to go. And I finally got the candle lit. And then when I blew out the match, I blew out the candle. But mercifully, the lights came up anyway. And then I do two little songs about my girls, my daughter Lisa and my daughter Jenny, who are now mothers. One of them is a mother herself. No, I can't remember even the rest of it. Songs like one of my favorite operas to do or works to do was A Little Night Music, which everyone in the United States is in love with Stephen Sondheim. And I did a production of it in Houston, and he came and coached us. So I do one of his songs. And then there's a very funny song called Amour by William Bolcom. And I had a very hard time in my life where lawyers were very much a part of my scene. And so my wonderful accompanist that I worked with for years, Martin Katz, said, I have just the song for you. And at one point, it's a girl who, her name is Amour, and everybody think she's gorgeous, but even when she goes to court, the judge even kind of tries to get a date with her, but the court part of it resonated with Marty, so he taught me that song. And then we sing, Tony and I sing these wonderful songs by Aaron Copland, just a couple of them at the end. The most fun one is I Bought Me a Cat.
That is fun. There's all kinds of animal sounds going back to your southern roots.
Yes.
Down on the farm.
Even Griffin.
Yeah. The pig actually says my last name spelled exactly the way I spell my name.
Yes. So,
and Flicka did that piece in Charlotte, North Carolina, and she said, Tony Griffey. And I was not expecting that. It was fun.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Sondheim came here to the Glimmerglass Festival last summer for a production of... what's the one where they eat humans?
Sweeney Todd.
And he did a talk back after the opera, and the place was packed, as you can imagine. He was interviewed by Jamie Bernstein, and they were asking him questions, and somebody said, well, what does it mean? What does Sweeney Todd mean? What's the deep meaning? And he's like, no, there's no meaning. It's just depressing and scary. That's all it means. It's just a story.
He was just amazing with all of us, too. You know, the song I sing is... isn't it, Rich? What is the name?
Send in the Clowns.
And he, you know, I kept trying to make it nice and sort of dear. And he said, no, Flicka, it's bitter. It's actor. In every career, there's a bitter part to it. It's keep it bitter. But it's still hard for me to do that.
Have you had a bitter part?
Oh, every career has a bitter part. But... I'm here to tell you, this is the good news for all of you young singers. You forget about it. You do. I can't remember. If I really struggle and strain, I can recall that feeling of devastation when I knew I was singing badly and had a bad night or something like that. I know it was there. It was there in not in excess, but it was certainly a good, healthy dose of it, but you do forget about it when you get older. I only remember the really wonderful times. And now people say, no, I remember when you sang this song. And I think, I've never sung that song in my life. I don't know that song.
Well, it's wonderful that you have this whole vocabulary to understand your own life, like a prism of music to see, you know?
Well, one thing that's been amazing has been my work with Jake Heggie, because the roles that he's asked me to be part of have been about women that it's been very easy to relate to them at the time of my life when I sang them. The first was in Dead Man Walking when I played the mother of the convict. And if you're a mom, you know that you can't protect your children from everything, and that some of the things you have done have hurt them. And that is excruciating. So to play the mother of someone whose sons, their life has gone off the rails, you know what that responsibility is, and yet if you're affected by poverty, there's often very little you can do. But it meant so much to look at that element in my own life through that character. And it is written to perfection, both the words of Terrence McNally and the incredible music of Jake Heggie.
Well, Jake was an Eastman grad, I believe.
Gene Shear. Yeah,
yes.
Jake was here last year, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I had the great fortune to do Jake's It's a Wonderful Life, the world premiere of that last year at the Houston Grand Opera.
Which is heaven on earth, yeah. That Wonderful Life. My husband and I went down to see it. I even think of it. I think of the angels floating around.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that because, you know, for a lot of our listeners, opera is this rarefied thing. And some people listening to your voices right now have never been to an opera. You know, what can opera offer us that nothing else can, that's at the core of this benefit, you know?
The core of this benefit is that opera's for all people. I didn't grow up with opera. I didn't see my first opera until I was a student in college, and I had no idea I'd become a quote-unquote opera singer. So it combines my love of acting and singing and my voice. I grew up Baptist, sort of being Catholic, so I grew up with knowing that and feeling that, you know, I had this gift to sing, and I wasn't sure exactly how I was going to use that gift or how, you know, how God would use me in that form. So operas is created, and we have these fascinating and wonderful stories. It's a Wonderful Life that I just did last holiday season at the Houston Grand Opera. I played the role of Uncle Billy. So my history with opera has primarily been that of tortured souls, Peter Grimes and Lenny and Mitch. And so I never really got the girl. And I lose the money and It's a Wonderful Life, you know. I found my own way into the world of classical music and opera. And it was really, you know, in keeping true to myself, you know, as I said earlier. So I think tomorrow, even folks that may not... maybe they've never been to an opera. Maybe they've not been to a classical concert. Tomorrow's there'll be something on the program for everyone. So
that sounds very intimate, what you're going to present.
What's exciting about opera now, in the last, say, 10 years, are there are incredible young opera composers. I mean, Jake, for me, is the top of the list. But they're dealing with very pertinent subjects. And when Dead Man Walking was debuted, and it's the story by Sister Helen Prejean of, it was a movie, and it's very true to the movie in the plot. It's a young man who does murder, and then it's his connection with this wonderful nun. And he, you know, how many people really want to go to a piece that begins with a murder and ends with an execution? It's not a toe-tapper, really. but it takes people to a place where we need to go now. And what safer way to go there than through music? And there was a lot of anxiety before the debut of Dead Man Walking. There were people that walked out, and then it was so popular that they had to add performances. And that piece is played... it's probably playing somewhere in the world every you know, every couple of months. I mean, I can't remember how many productions there have been. It resonates with everybody, all ages. I've seen student performances. I've seen professional performances. They're all just brilliant. And that's happening across the boards right now. And it's very, very exciting. And I think it's why opera is taking on another meaning. Also, what opera offers that is offered almost nowhere in the world today is directly throat to ear. And we have so much noise in the world. We have so much background sort of sound that when you actually tune your ear to hear the human voice with no amplification in a place that's safe, it's very, very exciting. And that really, in many regards, that it exists at all is miraculous. And it's sort of making a comeback in a different way. It's not the huge halls. There will always be the classics because they're extraordinary. But it's going someplace different, you know.
Well, Rochester soprano Kirsten Brown, I don't know if you've met her, but she was an understudy for John Adams in his new opera in San Francisco
yes.
a couple months ago. And she never got a chance to sing it publicly because the cast was healthy, unfortunately for her. But she did take excerpts out to prison outside of the city, and she said they were transfixed.
Yes.
Absolutely. They are transfixed. And
yes.
I've done a lot of work in the public schools, and so I'll go in and, you know, and sometimes the teacher will say, well, you know, they're not probably going to get what you're going to say. And I'll write opera on the board, and I'll say, how many of you know this word? And they'll all raise their hand, and they'll say, Oprah. And I'll say, well, it's close, but it's a little bit different. And so I talk about what an aria is, what a recitative yeah. is. And we do it a cappella. I don't bring an instrumentalist with me or anything. And they come up with a plot, and I talk, you know, and then we sing all the dialogue. And they're so fascinated. I mean, that's the key to our future is yeah. that they're so fascinated when I'll sing really high and then I'll sing really low, then I'll sing soft and they're where's your microphone? It's like,
yeah.
we don't use microphones in opera.
Yeah.
So, you know, the kids love it. And
yeah.
and I have several students at Eastman who are public school music education majors and are doubling in performance as well. And they just love going into the public schools and the kids love it.
Well, I have to ask two questions that are a little squirmy. The first one is about diversity in opera, and there's been a lot of talk about how many operas are being staged that were written by white men, and specifically dead white men. What are you seeing in your travels, Flicka?
I never think of it that way. You know, that's a real bugaboo in my heart that often young people of color don't get the opportunities that any of us have, but especially in music. And one of the most outstanding sort of instances I had was going to a concert at San Francisco Symphony of all the youth orchestras. And I think I counted 4 African-American kids and maybe 2 or 3 Latino kids. And I work with a group in Oakland called Young Musicians Choral Orchestra. And our kids are 10 to 18. And the purpose is through music to get them into university. And we have this amazing director named Daisy Newman, who is a wonderful singer, a great favorite of Lenny Bernstein. And she has given her life to these kids. And her theory is that they don't just deserve a smattering of music, you know, like this is opera, this is a violin, da da da. They are to be taught by the best. And we have a program where they get all their lessons paid for. We get their transportation. The families cannot earn over $20,000 a year. And it has been such a miracle to witness what's happened to our kids, that we had something like $800,000 in scholarships last year for our kids. And the talent is there. They just, you know, they haven't had the chance to study the violin at age 6. And they love it. And I take a lot of them to the opera dress rehearsals. And never has anyone wanted to leave early. And they were hard operas, too, because I have to see what's ever on the schedule. One of them was Don Giovanni, which is 4.5 hours. And they never wanted to go leave, and that's a lot for them. They've never heard anything. And I was sitting next to this kid who kept saying, "What's going to happen? What's going to happen to him?" And I said, "Bad things. He's bad. He's bad. It's just, can't you see how bad he is? Bad things are going to happen to him." The other opera was, now I can't remember it. I didn't even understand it. It was so complex, but it had wonderful sort of set designs. They just love it. And a lot of our kids have never heard anything really, really beautiful. They haven't, and they haven't seen anything really beautiful. And just the experience of walking in an opera house, which is marble and, it's exciting and there's...
That's transformative for sure. It might be one of the things that helps our country sort of on a different trajectory of, socioeconomic fairness and
absolutely.
I would hope anyway.
Absolutely. And so it's, there should be, it should be available to everybody. And if someone isn't exposed to it, how can they write music for opera
singers?
So it
starts at the beginning of their education.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, the other squirmy thing I do have to ask about is just about the other sea change that's happening in so many different industries, in entertainment, in politics, and in opera. And I know, Flicker, you've worked with James Levine and Charles Dutoit and even Garrison Keillor. And I'm wondering, do you think that there's going to be some kind of permanent change in opera and classical music that's happening in all these other fields? Is it going to stick? And how does that change the way you talk to your students?
Well, I have had I have worked with these gentlemen that these accusations have been come up about. I feel like I have always been a man of integrity and equality. As Flicka was saying earlier about, the work that she's doing out in the Bay Area in California, it all begins with early education. It begins with respect for one another, that we all come from diverse backgrounds, whether we're born male or female or, transgender. We're all in this together, and it has to begin with equal respect. And equality, and that's something that I try to instill in my students, and something that was instilled in me at an early age through observing how other people treated one another.
Has it changed the way you coach and train your own students at Eastman, the conversations that you have with them, or is it sort of a subterranean thing that's talked about in the hallways?
I'm very open with my students, given the fact that I'm still doing some performing and now I'm full-time teaching, is giving them a dose of what reality's like. And how do we achieve equality, and how can they, come to terms with that, and how can they be the next, they're our role models for the future, and how, as I, as their professor, how I can help instill within them the a journey that is of truth and of life, and that they will treat others with respect. I think, we live in a world now of desperate housewives, of, whatever, and we need to go back to remind ourselves and respect each other for our individuality.
I agree totally, and I think that the very nature of music begins with respect, because, first of all, if you're an instrumentalist, you're dealing with a very fragile object in your hands, especially if it's a violin, but all instruments, and the voice even more so. I think that the whole movement, the Me Too movement, is incredibly important. And even more important for people at the lower end of the economy. You know, it's sort of sensational when we're discussing film and the opera and what's happened to some of our colleagues. But it's really important for the gal who is supporting her family and is working in a hotel. That's where it matters the most. So the movement is vital. I think, like many of these movements, they're like huge nets that catch a lot of people. And some of that's almost a shame.
That's a good way
of
putting it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the stories that go around of... I remember I had one colleague when I was on tour with the Met, when the Met used to tour, this unbelievably handsome Italian bass. And he said, "Flica, I come and I sing outside your window at 2 o'clock in the morning. Is that all right with you?" And I said, "Oh, well, that's absolutely great, but I'm on the 43rd floor, you know." And I mean, it's the stories, you know, they're all Don Giovanni stories. And they're not always as threatening as they sound. You know, go back to the thought of the boss chasing the secretary around the desk. It's there's that element in it as well. Not to dismiss what power can do to some people and how it can distort their view of their purpose and where they are and what their powers are. So I totally agree with the movement. I do think the net has maybe drawn up some situations that are not as...
Everyone being painted with the same broad brush.
Same broad, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked with many of these people and I adore them, and I can't stop adoring them because of events in their lives.
Well, you have sung for the inauguration of Jimmy Carter, and you've, you know, been awarded medals at the White House, and you've sung for royalty, and you've toured with the Met, and now, finally, you've visited Rochester, New York.
This is it for me.
Now that your bucket list
is
complete.
This is the best. No, the best ever.
So seriously, what is left on your bucket list? Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you really, really want to do?
Not in my career. I'm so grateful to still be asked to do a couple of things here and there, more there than here. And I look back on it, on my career, with such enormous gratitude for every experience. I love my colleagues. I have loved every minute of being part of it. I really, my biggest bucket list will be to see my granddaughters get married, I think. I have one older granddaughter that's married, but the little ones too. I have a step-granddaughter who just sang for NATS, which is the National Association of Singing Teachers. Yeah, teachers.
National Association of Teachers of Singing. Yeah.
And she's 12, and they run a farm, she and her family. And she's done all these productions of, The Lion King, and loves singing. And all three of those of my step-grandchildren take music lessons, and she's loving singing. So it is such a thrill. And a colleague of mine was one of the judges and didn't know that we were related, but said she was just terrific. And she's presenting, she said she was terrified, but she loved it, you know. So that's pretty exciting.
Oh, that is wonderful.
And my two little granddaughters are, I would say, I don't know if they have voices yet, but they definitely have a gift for the stage. And whenever I sing around them, they're my worst critics. I say, "No, Nanny, no, 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 Nanny, please don't sing." So I don't get a very good review there.
Well, thank you both for making time to talk with us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast featuring mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stade with her friend and colleague Anthony Dean Griffey, preparing for a recital on Sunday evening, February 18th, 7 o'clock, in Kilburn Hall at the Eastman School of Music. I'm Brenda Tremblay. Thanks for listening. This has been a production of the WXXI Public Broadcasting Council.